And it's Steve Tasker who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy.
All right, welcome to the show on a Tuesday. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. And this will be the last show for a little bit, as the show will go dark for the next few days, as we typically do this time of year. Hey, we need a break, too. You know, that kind of thing.
Everybody deserves a break from us.
We'll be back on July 6th, and then we'll take another small hiatus because the NHL draft will be going on up in Montreal, and Duffer and Marty will have wall-to-wall coverage with three-hour shows on Thursday, July 7th, Friday, July 8th. So look out for that. I mean, heck, the Sabres got four picks in the top 41 selections.
All right, let's go.
A lot of fun to do a lot of stuff, whether you sit there and pick or you move around. It's going to be interesting, to say the least. So Duffer and Marty will have you covered for that, July 7th and 8th. Mm. So we get a little bit of a hiatus here.
We'll be back for one show next week,
Wednesday. July 6th. Yeah.
And then we'll be off for that week two for when the draft really kicks in. So.
That's right. It is Deshaun Watson hearing day, which began this morning. It's a closed hearing, so we don't even know it's done yet. The league has proposed discipline, as we know. According to multiple reports, the NFL wants an indefinite suspension of 1 year minimum. The league hopes to keep that open-ended, given the possibility that more claims will be made against Watson. Monday's lawsuit, in which the Texans were named, suggests at least, if you read through it, it's suggesting that at least six more lawsuits could be filed against Watson. So it's now just not just plus two, it's plus six. It's unclear how many can or will be filed against the team in addition to those six lawsuits that are expected to be levied against Watson here in the near future. So we'll have to see where it goes. I just saw right before we came on the air that Josina Anderson was tweeting about some stuff about the hearing. So I'm trying to read this in real time. She was told the NFL is expected to focus on the five women in its Deshaun Watson discipline case, but also that two of them had their claims dismissed by separate grand juries. Her understanding is the evidence will be presented by Watson's side, demonstrating purported mistruths in the allegations in said cases. I'm told in order to counter the indefinite suspension of at least a year that the NFL is reportedly seeking, Deshaun Watson's counsel will tactically reason for zero games missed. There is belief the open-ended suspension was leaked to still effort a settlement before a decision from hearing officer Sue Robinson, according to the league source. So it looks like we had heard earlier, or even late last week, that settlement talks between Watson's side and the NFL had broken down, and that the thing was going to go before Sue Robinson to adjudicate and levy a suspension, which obviously can be appealed by Watson, the PA, whatever. But it went to a hearing today. Sometimes, once you get both parties in a room, reaching a settlement suddenly becomes a whole lot easier. You know, deadlines, prompt action kind of thing.
Everybody's pretty cynical about this. They think that the one-year plus suspension or the at least one-year suspension was floated out there deliberately by the NFL because they knew they weren't going to be able to get that much because of all the other past cases and past history in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
And suspension this guy, he gave this guy this and that guy that and that guy that and that team that and that team that. And none of it added up to what Watson's getting. The thought is that they floated this out there, and so that they could come back and say if they didn't get it, or if it was something less than that, then they could say, well, we tried to get even more, so they could come out looking like they wanted to drop the hammer on them, they weren't allowed to, which makes them look like disciplinarians kind of thing. So. either way, it'll be interesting to see because there's certainly enough case, although I don't recall, Brownie, I don't recall a case like this. This is.
Well, especially, we had said this. Well, it's very bad, but we had also said yesterday, I can't recall a time where an accused party or a player facing NFL discipline approached the league prior to his case being adjudicated by the league in terms of violating the personal conduct policy and a suspension being handed down, coming in to negotiate a settlement. What the hell is that?
Yeah.
Like, I had never heard that before. So we're covering different ground here for sure. So
here's the thing that, and this is, it's interesting because this is the first time since the new collective bargaining agreement where this, they used to hash it out between the union and the league, and they used to, and it used to be real, a lot of animosity. So not only was Sue Robinson was jointly selected by the NFL and the union to act as this disciplinary
arbitrator.
Yeah,
she's like an independent arbitrator.
She's also paid by both. And she comes with pretty good credentials, and she was a federal judge and all that stuff. So she's a retired judge who's been at a high level in the U.S. court system, and she's being paid by both sides to be objective in this. So we'll see what it looks like when it comes down.
The other side of what happens to Deshaun Watson is what would the Browns do at quarterback if, in fact, he was facing a lengthy suspension? Would they just roll with Jacoby Brissett, try to convince Baker Mayfield to come back and play to boost his trade stock? At his football camp in Oklahoma, Mayfield was asked by a Sooner reporter if he would go back and play for the Browns if Watson was unavailable due to suspension. So Mayfield's answer, when asked if there was any chance for reconciliation with the Browns, said the following. And this is a quote that came from reporter Carrie Murdoch, who writes for a Sooner publication. Baker's answer, direct quote, "Any chance for reconciliation? No. I think for that to happen, there would have to be some reaching out. But we're ready to move on, I think, on both sides." And when he said reaching out, he meant the Browns reaching out to him. But it's his opinion that both sides have moved on. Every indication from just about every Cleveland reporter that has covered this from a Browns standpoint is indicating that the Browns have moved on from Mayfield. He's on their roster in name and contract obligation only, and there is no way that he is coming back to play for them in any capacity. So that's basically where that stands, which I think a lot of us anticipated. And you can't blame Mayfield for for feeling that way. I mean, he was basically thrown out like yesterday's trash.
After playing hurt.
In exchange, as the team made it clear, they preferred a guy with 24 lawsuits levied against him and decided to give him a fully guaranteed contract in the amount of $230 million when they wouldn't give Baker Mayfield an extension. You can argue that right, wrong, or indifferent. So from Mayfield's perspective, the bridge is burned, and I get why. So I don't see any way he goes back there. I think it's more likely he's playing for Carolina or Seattle before he puts an orange helmet on again.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. Baker's sitting on the sidelines waiting for this to come about, as are the Browns. Now, there's a couple of things that that Judge Robinson will look at. She's going to look at they're only bringing a handful of cases before her, and they're the ones that the league feels have the most substantive, credible, tangible evidence. Phone text conversations, testimonies, all of that stuff. And then she'll decide whether those things
merit
suspension or punishment of some kind. Then she'll go back and look and see if there are past infractions that are in the ballpark of what these allegations are, and how, if they are credible, if she believes, yes, they do have a case, yes, something did happen, then she'll go back and look, has this ever happened before? And what kind of suspensions did those accused get? Then you've got guys like Calvin Ridley, who's been suspended for a year for gambling $1,500.
At least the 2022 season.
At least this year.
For a $1,500 bet.
Right. Saints Bounty Gate, you know, for example, where Sean Payton, all these guys got
Greg
suspended
Williams.
For a year. And she'll see if there's any precedent set for these kind of things. It's basically that simple. She'll look at the atmosphere of what has happened in the past surrounding these allegations of this type, what the maximum sentences have been all across the league and all across allegations of any kind, and she'll try and fit it in to what it is. The guy's not getting off scot-free. And there's always going to be people who will say this much is not enough and that much is too much, whatever. But I think it's going to be the most interesting part about this is now they have an objective, experienced female judge looking at this evidence, hearing it, and she's not bound by anything except, all right, what are we doing here?
I think
that's really interesting.
Do you think the league, in presumably leaking that they want at least a suspension of one season, was done to serve as a weather balloon to see how the public reacted to that? Or do you think it was more to influence the independent arbitrator, Sue Robinson?
Yeah, I think it's at least to set a baseline in the league's mind. And I think it was...
Because the league's not deciding this punishment. The independent
right.
arbitrator is.
Yes. Sue Robinson is going to decide this after hearing evidence. And she's no grand jury. She didn't have to, you know...
No, it's her and her alone.
It is the personal conduct policy of the NFL that's at stake here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. So I'm... None of us have read or, you know, read the briefs or anything like that or the what these text messages, you know, we've all got snippets of stuff where we've heard, you know, Watson reached out to some of the victims afterwards and, you know, tried to make amends or whatever. All of that goes into the stew and gets cooked. No, but I think the league put out as they're not going to say ban the guy for life, but
no,
they want to get something out of him. They want to come off getting him for a year, I think, is reasonable given what's happened.
Speaking of court cases, Washington Commanders owner Dan Snyder has not yet accepted a subpoena issued by the U.S. House Oversight Committee investigating allegations that he fostered a toxic work culture with the Washington Commanders Football Club. A spokesperson for the committee, apparently they sent the subpoena to his lawyer's office, and the lawyer's like, yeah, I'm not accepting that. So
it's hard to serve him papers when he's in France. Is that
so the committee attempted to send the subpoena to Snyder's attorney via email on Friday, but Karen Seymour, one of Snyder's lawyers, declined to accept it, according to two sources familiar with the ongoing negotiation between the committee and Snyder's attorneys. Last week, the chair of the committee, Karen Lynn Maloney, Democrat from New York, announced she would issue the subpoena for Snyder to be deposed by congressional investigators after his attorney repeatedly declined the committee's invitation to testify with NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, who appeared in a hearing last week. Quote, the committee will not be deterred from obtaining Mr. Snyder's testimony, and we remain committed to ensuring transparency about the toxic workplace culture at the Washington Commanders and the NFL's inadequate response. So that's where that stands. I mean, I don't know how successfully can you run from a subpoena that was sent electronically by email? Like, you just don't open it, so that means you weren't served? They're going to have to hand deliver this thing.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you do that with these, you know,
oh, yeah.
court papers. You have to physically be served with papers. So somebody's like chasing the person down.
An officer of the court has to physically hand it to the person after that person identifies himself or is known to the person. So we've all seen court cases. I remember.
Guy's going to the parking lot to his car, and this person runs him down and hands him.
True story. Back in the day, my play-by-play guy was Bill McAtee.
Okay.
Great dude. We're still friends, obviously. He's a great guy. And he works for CBS Sports, does some golf, he's a real troubleshooter for them, can do a ton of real versatile play-by-play guy. And he says, yeah, I got a chance, and we were sitting at dinner, and this is back in the 70s or 80s, talking to Al Davis, and they were chit-chatting, and Al was a big Civil War buff, I guess, or is it Civil War or something? There was a history event like World War II or Civil War or something like that. And Al was a fan, you know. And they were talking about it, and Bill said, "Yeah, I read this book." And Al said, "What book was it?" He says, "Well, I got, you know, this book." And he said, "Oh, that's cool." So Bill McAtee went out and bought the book. Knew he had the Raiders again in a couple of weeks, so he got the book, wrapped it, and had it, and it was down on the field. And then here comes Al, and Bill is going to hand him the book. And here's why I bring it up. Al wouldn't take the buck. He goes, "Whoa, what do you have?" He goes, "Hand it to him." He thought he was getting served.
Well, let's just say he spent an awful lot of time in the courtroom.
It was great.
That's hilarious.
He had him hand the book to his guy next to him. So
that's great.
That's what happens when he gets served. Dan Snyder, you talk about a slippery dude. You know what? I'd like to.
I'm on my boat in the Atlantic.
I got a pressing business in the south of France on my yacht, so I'm going to be unavailable, and my lawyers won't accept anything you hand them either. So, man, oh, man.
I don't know how long you're going to be able to stall him.
Yeah, how long is that going to – is he just going
to – throw a lasso around the guy and just bring him down to the Capitol? I mean, what are we doing here? Found this quote interesting, Steve, from Kayvon Thibodeau. I don't know if you saw this. One of the Giants' top 10 picks in the draft this year, pass rusher out of Oregon, said he's going to be ready for his first NFL training camp when the Giants report on July 19th. The number 5 overall pick in the draft reportedly sustained a minor hip injury during a spring practice, but he's going to be fine. But this was the part that caught my eye. He basically said, you got to compartmentalize your rookie season. And this is what he said, quote, "If I could average at least one sack a game or contribute 5 to 10 tackles a game, then I'll be good." How much of a rude awakening is Kayvon Thibodeau in for? A sack a game you're going to average? So as a rookie, you're going to finish with at least 17 sacks. That's what he's telling us.
Good luck, bro. Or it were 5 tackles. So, yeah. Hey, set your sights high, man. Good for you. Okay.
All right. I mean, he's talented. Don't get me wrong. I think he'll have a measure
of
success.
That's the thing. I think some of these, and it's something
it's a different level,
year.
Guy.
People who watch the league a lot and have seen and done it for years, you know, how many tremendous athletes have come out of college football and you think, man, oh, man, this guy. And they come out, and a lot of players, they come out thinking, man, I'm going to tear it up here. Here we go. And they walk out onto the field, and all of a sudden, there ain't no dental students out there. Yeah. You know, they're not playing against an engineering kid. They're not playing against college students. They're playing against guys who are every bit of, if not more gifted than they are, and smarter and nastier. It's a rude awakening for some of these guys. I'm not saying this is going to happen to Kayvon Thibodeau, but it's so typical of what college athletes get an idea about when they come out of those ranks.
Yeah.
Now, even a college Power 5 guy.
I will say Thibodeau is doing all the right things. He's kind of buddied up with Michael Strahan, who's given him a lot of advice. He has got a strict daily regimen that includes hours of training at 3 different times a day. He's also, you know, getting treatments for his body. So he's got a regimen laid out already. He's certainly setting himself up for success, but I thought that was awfully lofty for a rookie who's never played an NFL game before.
Well, you got to
sack
your,
a game.
You got to set your sights really, really
I
high.
I get it, but
you got to set your sights. I get that. No problem with that.
It's not too many pass rushers, even the best of the best, coming out of the chute with that kind of a season as a rookie.
I get it. Hey, he's working out 3 times a day. Awesome. That's just great. Why do you think nobody else does that? You think you want it more than anybody else ever in the history of the league? Bro, come on. I got news for you.
That's my point.
You got to – there's a reason nobody else does that. It's because when you show up for training camp and you turn on the adrenaline once, all of a sudden, there goes your Achilles because your adrenaline pops in and you didn't have enough rest.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you pull a hamstring, you can't get on the field, or you blow a knee, or you do this, you do that, something pops. You can't, I mean, the reason guys don't And I get it. You think the more I do, the better it's going to be. But that's – it's working out and being a pro athlete is a little bit like being on a prescription from your doctor. You take it when you're supposed to take it, and you don't take it when you're not supposed to take it. You know what I'm saying? If you don't take all the pills at once, you take them a little bit at a time.
Yeah.
That's how you get cured. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
These guys come in and they think they're going to reinvent it. They think nobody has ever wanted it in the history of the game more than they want it. So, and they're proving it because they're working out three times a day. Bro, just take a deep breath and realize that you're going to have to do it smart, not just hard. And, you know, I mean, just more working out is not always the answer.
I don't know if you saw this, Steve, but a handful of Notre Dame football players, including Ravens first-round pick Kyle Hamilton, have a podcast called Inside the Garage. They had Jordan Poyer on, and they asked him about Bills cornerback Nick McCloud, who they all knew because after playing his first 3 years at NC State, he played his final year at Notre Dame with all of those guys on the podcast. Poyer said that McCloud reminds him of himself. McCloud spent his rookie year on Buffalo's practice squad, a bit of time with the Cincinnati Bengals roster because they picked him up after final cuts late last summer. Back with the Bills now, the Bills have not only lined him up at cornerback, but safety as well to gauge his position flexibility. But I liked him coming in last year. Big corner, great build, has some length, physicality. Poyer said he's working for everything, said he saw growth in his game at minicamp. But the bottom line, Steve, is McCloud is in a deep pool of reserve candidates here on Buffalo's roster. It's going to be a challenge for him to make the 53. I mean, you think about that second tier of corners. It's essentially Tim Harris, Saran Neal, Cam Lewis, Christian Benford, Nick McCloud, Elijah Griffin, Trayvon Fuller, an undrafted rookie, and Jamarcus Ingram, an undrafted rookie. I mean, that's seven guys behind the perceived locks who are White, Jackson, Johnson, Elam, and Neal.
Right.
And then I would surmise going into camp, Cam Lewis is probably number six.
That's a good bet. Because, you know, the fourth or fifth corner on the game day roster on the 53 is going to be a special teams guy.
Yeah, it's Saran Neal.
And that, you know, it knocks it down a notch.
I mean, that's going to be tough,
Trey
man.
White, Saran Neal, Cam Lewis, Taron Johnson.
Dane Jackson. Kyrie Elam. I mean, that's your top five
draft,
or six.
And he got another draft pick.
Benford, yeah.
Christian Benford, who's 6'1", 205, who's, you know, got some length.
It's going to be tough.
It's a tough room to make. It's a tough roster to make. I've said it. I've made that analogy before about the teams that I was on that were going to the Super Bowl every year. You get these guys in there that are really good, and they can't make them. Back then, the rules were different. You couldn't keep guys around. You had to release guys. They'd go on to have really nice careers in other places because the roster was just too deep and talented for them to make it. But they could go to another place, make it, contribute, put together a nice career. Some of that is going to go on here in Buffalo. And corner is just one of those spots. Even with the question mark with Tre'Davious White, you know, and how he's going to come back and how,
right.
You know, maybe they keep an extra corner to begin with the season to make sure Trey, you know, gets back on two good feet.
Which makes it interesting when you think about, because every time you're keeping DBs on the roster, there's always a balance there. How many corners, how many safeties? You only have two safety spots on a field. You have three corner spots, especially in this defense, which plays nickel 91% of the time last year.
Nickel's their base defense.
So do you keep an extra corner? And then it kind of makes sense as to why they're lining up McCloud a little bit at safety. Are they looking at him as a swing option? You know, a corner safety swing in the event that White's not ready. We have the extra corner in supply, and then we're not really hurting ourselves at safety because he could slide over there too. We know Saran Neal has a lot of experience at both corner and safety. So it's going to be interesting to see if they cross-train two or three guys.
Right.
And then that becomes the quote-unquote sixth corner / fifth safety, you know, because Tre'Davious White may not be ready for week one, for example. We don't know, but I'm just saying these are contingencies that coaching staffs are building into their practice regimen all the time, so they have potential answers if they need to turn to them.
Right, and we always hear about position flexibility, but you always think about maybe defensive line, defensive tackle,
offensive
guard, offensive tackle, that kind of. But if you get out in the athletes, you know, tight end, running back, wide receiver, safety, corner, slot, outside, all of that's important. And it's just, it sounds simple, but it really is sometimes that simple. This guy can play more spots than that guy. He's in, he's out.
And Jordan Poyer started as a corner and then transitioned to safety. Could Nick McLeod be on a similar track? We don't know yet, but
they're
experimenting.
If you stereotype, and of course this is just what it is, a stereotype, doesn't hold true. Corners are higher in athleticism. Safeties are higher in cognitive, knowing the whole defense.
Football IQ,
meshing fronts with coverages, knowing where the linebackers are and where they fit, where the rush is coming from, where the weaknesses are. Those guys are more cerebral, and the outside guys, because of the nature of the business, are the more athletes. So when a guy as a corner starts to lose a step when he gets 29, 30, 31 years old, he slides over to safety, and his experience carries him through there, a la Charles Woodson, those kind of guys.
Mm-hmm. Charles Woodson, Rod Woodson.
Yeah, there have been other – Deion Sanders could have played anywhere in the secondary. guys like that you can do that with, and it's a plus. And given what we know about player development here in Buffalo, I think that may be a bigger factor than we've given it credit for.
Speaking of cornerbacks, I found this interesting. We have our camp countdown series running on BuffaloBills.com with some positional previews, camp battles, some outlooks for the offense, defense, and special teams. Today's installment focused on how guys like Dane Jackson and Kyir Elam will compete for a starting role at cornerback. And I found some of Elam's comments in the piece very interesting. Listen to this, Steve. The biggest lesson I learned in the spring practices was situational football, said Elam. My growth and knowledge about situational football have grown tremendously. In the short amount of time I've been here, I've learned so much and I'm still learning to this day. Learning what the offense is expecting and what the defensive coordinator is trying to do to counter that, I think that's grown exponentially thanks to Coach McDermott. He preaches and harps on that daily. Also, the importance of taking the ball away in this league. It's super duper hard, and the great ones can do it consistently. Situational football. Are you somewhat surprised that that is not taught more stringently at the college level? Because this is clearly an eye-opener for Kyir Elam.
I don't think so. I think that at the college level, and let's face it, those guys get 20 hours a week in college to go in there. That includes practice.
So there's no time to sweat the details?
Yeah, you got to play it like this. Now, certainly situational football does play a role, no question about it, but I think it falls more on the coaching staffs than it does on players and individual. Because the coaches will say, listen, in this situation, we want these three guys on the field instead of those three. That kind of thing. They'll because you got 9,000 guys on your – I'm exaggerating. You got 90 guys on your roster, and you can pick and choose which athletes you want in a given situation due to their skill sets if you can get to know them that well. So I think that situational football at the college level falls on the coaching staffs and strategy rather than having guys out there saying, you know what, hey, on this down and distance, they like to do this and this, and they're going to try and hit us here. Particularly if we show this defense, they have a tendency to strike right here. So let's be ready for that and jump it. That kind of down and distance awareness – it's hard, and it changes drastically on a week-to-week basis because of your opponent.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
You know, so
the amount of variables are infinite.
Yeah, so that takes some wherewithal and some experience and some real next level.
And no matter how smart you are, it takes time, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Time to master, time on task, for sure. But I just thought it was very eye-opening to me that the level of situational – I would always expect at the NFL level – the degree of situational football is at its peak, but Elam almost made it sound like, oh, wow, like outside of in college football saying it's third down, we probably got a pass coming here. It doesn't sound like it goes a whole lot deeper than that.
Yeah, and I think also it's nice that he got that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty impressive that he's
– that kid's a sponge.
Yeah, I like that about it too, and I like where his – you know, that he had that answer ready, too, mm-hmm. when he was asked. He said, listen, the situational football thing is huge. Because it is. It is. And it's an aspect that a lot of people, we don't really talk about because it's so specific to each game and each matchup.
Yeah. We have to take a break here. The OBL fan mailbag is open for you if you have any questions for us. Since we have a shortened week here, with this being our last show of the week, that is open for you to peruse at One Bills Live. When we come back, though, Bills Hall of Fame coach Marv Levy sat down with Steve and his son Luke. We will explain, but we'll be bringing that to you next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back to One Bills Live. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. We're going to bring Hall of Fame coach Marv Levy to you in a second, but Steve needs to explain, since it was him and his son Luke that were able to talk to him.
A couple of weeks ago, Marv got inducted into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame, and the Hall of Fame, for those of you who don't know, is in Hamilton, Ontario, and some of you do know, my son Luke is the radio analyst for the Hamilton Tiger Cats. So through all of that, we decided to team up together, try and get Marv on, because Marv couldn't travel to the ceremony. So we got Marv on a Zoom call, my son Luke and I, to talk to him about his induction into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame, in conjunction also with his induction into the Pro Football Hall of Fame so many years ago, becoming only one of three people to be in both those halls of fame, joining Bud Grant and Warren Moon. Here's the interview with Luke Tasker, the radio analyst for the Hamilton Tiger Cats, and myself a week or so ago with Marv Levy.
Well, Marv, thanks for coming on with us, and congratulations on your induction to the Canadian Football Hall of Fame. What was your reaction to getting the call?
Oh, I tell you, I was overwhelmed that it would happen. I didn't at the time know the president of the current president, the Montreal Alouettes, Mario Cecchini, but I think he's the man who maybe worked very hard on getting that to come to fruition. But I was overwhelmingly complimented to hear that. It's been a long time since I left there. There were only five of my 47 coaching years there were in Montreal, but they remained very prominent in my memories. I really enjoyed them.
And you joined an elite list, Marv. There's only three people that are in the Pro Football Hall of Fame and the Canadian Football Hall of Fame. It's you, Bud Grant, and Warren Moon in both halls. That's got to make you feel really special.
Absolutely. I was aware of that. I did know Bud Grant well, competed against him in Canada, and then competed against him when I was the coach of the Kansas City Chiefs, and he is with the Vikings. I had high regard for him. Whatever I knew about Warren Moon also was very high, and Steve will remember that one when we had the great comeback game against the Oilers with Warren down there. But, I'm overwhelmingly complimented to join those two in both halls of fame.
Yeah, that's a special group of men. And Dad, you played with Warren Moon also in Houston. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I'm connected to both you and Warren. Warren was a teammate of mine in my rookie season with the Houston Oilers, and then of course I played with you for over a decade. I was going to ask you a little bit about your Canadian football career, Marv. My son Luke played for the Hamilton Tiger Cats, and I never saw this. But I heard stories about this place called Ivor Wynne Stadium. And it's one of those things where the locals seem to really love it, and nobody else did. Do you remember Ivor Wynne Stadium in Hamilton, Ontario?
Well, very, very faintly, Steve. What I really remember more than anything there is one of our Grey Cup championship games in Calgary, where it was about 20 below zero, and I wound up with a frostbite that hasn't left me since. But
no kidding.
No, I remember going to Hamilton. I enjoyed the time there. But it was an in-and-out type of experience in most of those places. And I know that, Luke, you've played there with the Tiger Cats, and everybody there that I've heard from sure does have high esteem for you.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Hamilton, Marv, is very much a Buffalo-like community in Canada, and they take and hold the Ticats dear to heart, very much so like Buffalo does for the Bills. And Ivor Wynne is now no longer standing, but Tim Hortons Field is the home of the Hamilton Tiger Cats and the home of the Canadian Football Hall of Fame, where your bust now sits for all football future to come. So that's very, very cool. The my head coach for some of my seasons in Canada also was inducted alongside of you for the Canadian Football Hall of Fame, and that is Orlando Steinhauer, who is the current head coach of the Hamilton Tiger Cats. So, Marv, it was very special. I had my head coach and my dad's head coach in the same class for the Canadian Hall of Fame. Very cool.
Oh, it sure is. No, the history is great. Would take a lot of study to catch up on it. I know you're doing a lot of that with the role you're playing and did play before. So, boy, what an honor and joy it is for me to talk with the Taskers and to convey through you to those great fans in Canada my fondest memories of my days up there.
All right, Marv, last question for me. I don't want to take us down a rabbit hole or anything, but you were known as a special teams champion, and some of the things, I watched a lot of Canadian football when Luke was playing in Canada, and there are a ton of differences. It's a different game. There's no doubt about it. But there are a lot of similarities as well. And one of the things I would like to see, and I want you to get your take, is some of the special teams differences that there are in Canada. And I don't know if you can actually speak to it after so long, but some of the rules that they have in Canada are completely different than they are in the NFL. And I was wondering how likely or how prevalent was it that you've seen the NFL adopt rules like that and change? And what would you like to see different about the NFL, if anything?
Well, I'd like to see the Buffalo Bills win the Super Bowl. That's But no, the leagues are different. It really is the same things win. If you run, throw, block, tackle, catch, kick better than your opponent, you're going to win whether it's the CFL or the NFL. Yes, the rules are different. I don't know, maybe some of the Canadian League rules have changed.
Did you hate yourself?
When I was up there. But you could have men in motion towards the line of scrimmage, 12 people on a team. We used to have a 20-yard end zone then. The field had more than twice the square yardage of an NFL field. Again, there have probably been changes made about which I'm not really aware, but I remember that the athletic director up there, when I was first brought in, J.I. Albrecht, told me, Marv, you got 12 men on the team. I said, oh, okay, an extra receiver. And after the first game, he came back in the office. I said, hey, J.I., you didn't tell me the other team could have 12 men also. But no, the rules are different, but they're interesting. Some of them are very exciting. They keep the game really going at high pitch.
Hey, Marv, I got to think that you came to Buffalo after your time in Kansas City, which came after your CFL years, and I've always been told your first game as a Buffalo Bill was also one other player's first game as a Buffalo Bill, and that was Steve Tasker. And I got to think Bill Polian and Marv Levy, both with CFL experience and putting an emphasis on special teams play, is there something about that attracted you to the young wide receiver special teams ace for the Houston Oilers?
Yeah, I'll tell you the story. I remember it well. I was hired in midseason to take over as the head coach of the Buffalo Bills in 1986 midseason, and I retained the members of the coaching staff. Mr. Wilson fired the head coach, Hank Bulla. I retained the members of his coaching staff through that year. One of them, Joe Farragelli, who had formerly been on the coaching staff with the Oilers when Steve was there. And the rules in the NFL at that time, if a player was placed on injured reserve, which Steve was with an injury, you could not just activate him off of it. You had to put him up for waivers. And if no one claimed him, you could, re-sign him or activate him. Well, the Oilers placed him on waivers, apparently with the very strong intent of re-signing him. Whoever knew about a guy, he was a bit of a lower-round draft choice, wasn't real big. And anyway, Joe Farragelli came in and said, Marv, I know your love of the special teams. I'm telling you, this is the guy you want to claim. And so we went down the hall, talked to our general manager, Bill Polian, said, okay, let's claim him. What the heck? Boy, was that a great move. I am always grateful to Farragelli, to Polian, to Tasker, and to so many more.
Well, Marv, thanks so much for spending some time with us. Congratulations on an induction into what I guess has got to be yet another Hall of Fame. This one, the CFL, one of only three people to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame and in the Canadian Football Hall of Fame. Congratulations, and thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you, Steve, and the day will come. I am certainly hopeful, and I believe it, that I've been campaigning hard, and Bill Polian, too, and some others. You've been on the brink of induction into the NFL Pro Football Hall of Fame, and that day should come. Anyway, thank you all, and thanks for your friendship, your ability, and so much more.
Thanks, Marv.
Thanks, Marv.
All right, Hall of Fame coach Marv Levy checking in with the Taskers there after going into the CFL Hall of Fame a week or so ago. And now, as you heard the guy say, one of just three people to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame and the Canadian Football Hall of Fame, the other two being pretty much Warren Moon and Bud Grant. That's it.
That's the
it's
list.
A short list.
That's the list.
Pretty cool.
It was pretty cool. Marv was in great spirits. Great interview, as always. And, he kind of doesn't like to travel for the last year or two for obvious reasons, the pandemic and stuff. But it was nice enough to come on with us.
We will take a break here. When we come back, there's a little bit of an update regarding Deshaun Watson's hearing today. And we'll have an update on a boxing match between two, NFL running backs. They're soon to be former running backs, I suppose, since they don't have work right now. We'll let you know who's involved. And Steve and I may pick who we think could win the dang thing next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back. One Bills Live. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. The update concerning the Deshaun Watson closed hearing today with the NFL, NFLPA independent arbitrator, Sue Robinson, is that the hearing today could go well into tomorrow. That according to CBS Sports reporter Jonathan Jones. The NFL, the Players Association, and Watson's legal team will all be presenting their cases. The NFL is expected, as we know, to push for an indefinite suspension of at least a year. The judge's decision is expected sometime this week. Of course, we are all predicting it'll be a Friday 5 p.m. news dump where they hope it's not given the coverage that maybe some feel it deserves because it's on the cusp of a holiday weekend. The other news that we wanted to bring to you concerned two veteran running backs from the NFL who have signed on to engage in an exhibition boxing match. Le'Veon Bell and Adrian Peterson are going to get in the ring and fight each other. I'm not going to pretend to know if either of these men have a boxing background of any kind or whether they've ever incorporated boxing type training into their off-season regimen, but you want to pick a guy in this one, Steve?
I don't bet against Adrian Peterson. He's got some size.
I'm going there,
and they're not that different in age. Maybe what, 6 or 8 years tops?
Is it that much?
I don't even know if it's that much. That's most. That's at most. But Adrian Peterson has, he's kind of a freak of nature.
He is,
and I don't. And I think that whichever one has less, I don't know if you could possibly have less fighting experience than these two guys, which makes it a little more interesting, so that one guy hasn't been training to be a fighter his whole life as a crossover from football, and the other guy hasn't.
You're right. Adrian Peterson is 37. Bell is just 30.
Right. So those are important years, though, particularly in athletics.
Right.
The 30, age 30 year to the 37 year.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Probably only going to be. Did you see how long it's supposed to go? Those usually only go six rounds tops. I don't know.
So maybe be three rounds.
It probably might only be three. It might only be three. Yeah.
I'm telling you what. We used to fool around with all kinds of cross training with gymnastics and all.
MMA stuff and fight stuff. You go 3 minutes trying to punch a bag, you're done.
It's a lot of work.
Oh my gosh. It's incredibly difficult. Plus you add the spice of adrenaline. Once you do that, step into the ring where you're going to get hit. I'd pass out in 20 seconds. My adrenaline would just kill me. My own adrenaline. Oh my gosh.
So tale of the tape.
It makes sense. I mean, I always thought that's what the fight game was. And only now in this, you know, current point in history are we starting to get more and more odd matchups, right? They're not professional fighters, but let's see them fight. Le'Veon Bell and Adrian Peterson.
So they're both 6'1". As we already mentioned, Bell is 7 years younger at 30. Peterson's 37. Bell weighs 225, Peterson 217. And we know they've both been multiple Pro Bowlers. As we know, Peterson was an MVP, former NFL Offensive Player of the Year. Neither of them are officially retired from the NFL.
They haven't signed the paperwork.
Bell was with Tampa and Baltimore last year for a total of 8 games. Peterson was with Tennessee and Seattle for a total of 4 games last season.
It's interesting. These guys wait for a while before they sign their, you know, their retirement papers. I guess Brett Favre started all that, right, with unretiring and retiring. Interesting. But
so
whatever.
Boxing has apparently long been a passion for Bell, who used the sport as cardio during his time with the Steelers. So, and his passion for the sport grew during his year away from football in 2018 when he decided not to re-sign with the Steelers.
Frank Gore probably opened up that door for people, too.
Yeah, Frank. He had a fight or two.
Yeah.
We actually had some of that footage here a couple of months ago.
He actually won his fight.
He did. No details on how many rounds this thing's supposed to go, but my guess would be 3. I would agree with that.
Yeah, but I don't know. That's Le'Veon Bell and Adrian Peterson.
Yeah, I don't know why. I'm going with Peterson in that one. I expect him. Although Bell, you know, he said he's, you know, he's at least done boxing type training as part of his off-season regimen. So maybe that gives him an advantage. But when somebody's standing in front of you, it's a whole different ball game compared to shadow boxing.
Right. Nobody's swinging at him.
Yeah. You get punched in the mouth, things change pretty quickly.
We've all heard that Mike Tyson saying, yeah, everybody's got a plan until you get hit in the face.
Yeah, that's right. That is a great quote, isn't it?
That's one of the all-time.
Leave it to Mike.
That may be the all-time greatest quote for anybody, for any fighter for sure. You can remember when Sonny Liston said this about Cash, then it was Cassius Clay. He can run, but he can't hide. That was a good one.
Yeah.
But everybody's got a plan until they get hit in the face is an even better one.
Because it's true.
It's so true.
Very true.
So true. Oh. Yeah, so imagine, you know, for whatever amount of money you want to slap down on a pay-per-view, you'll get that
fight. Wow. Did pay-per-view pick that up? I don't know.
Isn't that the only way you can get? I mean, how else are they going to do it? Why else would they do it if they're not going to get paid and paid handsomely?
Oh, there's definitely money involved.
Right?
It's going to take place out in L.A. So
L.A., not Vegas?
No. Los Angeles is where the two are supposed to fight, according to the write-up that I saw on it.
All right.
So we'll have to see what comes of it. We'll have to see if either of these guys was evidently training. So, yeah. I think it could be entertaining. I mean, two pretty big dudes, too. This would qualify as a heavyweight bout.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Two guys, 6'1", and over 2 bills. Yeah, that's a heavyweight bout right there. So, you know, the punching power will be there. I know I've told you, like, I've only attended a couple of boxing matches where I've been close enough to appreciate the power being generated by big humans. And one of them was a heavyweight match. And it was the first one I had ever been to.
Right.
And TV does not do it justice because the power of the bombs these guys are throwing does not come through the television. It just doesn't. And then when you're there, if you're sitting close enough, you'll wince a little bit sometimes. Like the first round, I'm sitting there going, oh, man, oh, man.
See, that's the thing. I've been to all just about every major sports pinnacle event, a World Series game, Super Bowl, obviously, NBA games. Boston Marathon,
Boston
car races, you know, horse races, hockey games, Stanley Cup final games. I mean, you go, you know, now I've never been to a prize fight. I've never been to a fight. And back in the day, Bruce was and still is good friends with Sweet Pea Pernell Whitaker.
Yeah.
Who was, you know, kind of his thing was that he was the best pound-for-pound fighter in, on the planet, right?
Really fast
So Bruce,
hands.
And they were both from Virginia Beach. So yeah. Bruce and Sweet Pea were real buddies. So they all went out. All the guys went off season, went out to watch Sweet Pea fight. And they came back absolutely bonkers over what they saw. They couldn't. They were like, "Oh my gosh, we couldn't."
And that's
couldn't believe it.
He was like a lightweight. He wasn't even a
right.
big fighter. You
right.
know, not that those guys can't.
You can imagine the electricity. I can't even imagine the electricity in the joint when these guys walk out. You know, when it, you know, the big run up. Can you imagine the old Ali Frazier fights?
Oh
my gosh.
Foreman.
Mike Tyson and, you know.
Now, I will say, Mike Tyson's punching power, that did translate to television.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just.
Mike Tyson, Leon, or Michael Spinks.
I mean, I was only a teenager when he was fighting, but there were times I'd be watching fights going, he might take this guy's head clean
right.
off his shoulders.
Who'd Mike Tyson's, whose ear did he bite off? Evander Holyfield.
Evander Holyfield.
The two of those, we had Evander Holyfield on the show when we were at the Super Bowl one time, and he came on with us, and it's crazy to think about the electricity in the air of one of those fights.
It's bananas.
It's like that, you know, the Super Bowl. I've been in and around those a bunch, and it's a little bit like that. NBA games where those guys come walking out of the tunnel, and you know, and people are close in NBA games. Really close to the action. You know, there's nothing there. In hockey, it's a little different because there's glass and all of that stuff, but those guys are tooling around with a stick in there. Yeah, the electricity. I got to go to a fight sometime. I got to go.
Pretty crazy.
I want to see one of those.
We have to take a break here. Hour number two coming your way, and we'll be joined by producer and director Jake Simperman, who put together a documentary on the first wheelchair football team in Buffalo. Plenty more on that when we return. Here on One Bills Live, presented by Kalata Health, it's Buffalo Bills Radio.
Tasker, touchdown, Buffalo. And it's Steve Tasker who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp? We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy.
I was waiting. And then we were blessed with wheelchair football.
This game means everything. We should be slamming, should be falling, sweating, bleeding, just to make it down that field.
Let's go!
Guys who are here every day are going to play. Guys who are working hard and showing commitment are going
to
play.
This is brand new, and we're excited to be one of only 9 cities across the country.
No matter what, this right here is the first Buffalo wheelchair football team.
Let's go, Buffalo!
Let's go, Buffalo!
Let's go, Buffalo!
All right, what our MSG viewers were just watching and what our radio listeners were listening to was a documentary on the first Buffalo wheelchair football team. The documentary is called Concrete Gridiron. And joining us now on the show is the producer and director of that doc, Jake Simperman, joining us here. How you doing, Jake?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. And what a nice surprise to be following up my friend and former hockey teammate, Luke Tasker.
Yeah, there you go. That's right. Yeah, Jake grew up in NEA, and actually his dad's a friend of mine. But we found out about this documentary, and it tells the story of this group of guys who – and this, let's face it, this is just a fledgling sport, to say the least. And, of course, Buffalo, one of, I think, what,
nine
NFL cities that have teams – and kind of just started from scratch. Give us a little idea about the story that you tell.
Yeah, so like you mentioned, I mean, this is really focused on two of the main players on this team. And I mean, all these guys come from such different and fascinating backgrounds. It was really difficult to decide who to focus on. But it's really about their personal journeys. And, you know, you have to remember, most of these guys have never played football before. So it's a total learning experience. And it's just amazing to see them develop and the things that they're able to do physically. So it's been a pleasure to work with these guys.
And I'm curious, Jake, to know how this became your project. So why don't you just, like, lay out how you became involved and how this kind of became your baby, this documentary.
Yeah, so kind of funny. I ran into my old football coach from high school, Tim Wade, at a music festival in East Aurora, Borderland Music Festival. And, you know, I wanted to know how retirement life was treating him. And it turned out he wasn't so retired. In fact, he was coaching an entirely new sport, wheelchair football. And as he, you know, began to describe the game to me, I was immediately fascinated. And, you know, practices were starting in a few days. So, you know, Monday morning I called him and I just said, look, like, this sounds incredible. And just coming from a filmmaking background, like, I'd love to be a part of this first season. And to their credit, they welcomed me with open arms, and it kind of just took off from there.
And this, you know, this started obviously with low expectations, and this was more about an activity that it was more about the players than it was about the sport. If I'm not mistaken, is that kind of the right way to look at this? This whole sport is more about the players who play it than it is about, at least for us and people watching, it's more about the players than it is about the wheelchair sport.
Yeah, I mean, look, wheelchair football is an incredible outlet for these guys, you know, to be competing in. But I think giving them a chance to be a part of a team and to be able to experience football and the camaraderie and, you know, competitive spirit, like, you know, to me, that's what this is all about.
And your documentary here is going to be kind of the centerpiece of a fundraising effort right in East Aurora, right?
Yeah. So tonight it's premiering at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6 at the Aurora Theater. And that's kind of just one component of this fundraising effort. After that, there's going to be a little party at 42 North Brewing Company right down the street. So there's lots of opportunities for people to get involved and donate and, you know, meet the players. I think that's going to be a lot of fun tonight for people to meet these guys in person. They're awesome. They're inspiring, but they're also hilarious. So, you know, to get all the team together in Buffalo, it's going to be a really fun night.
So tonight, 7 o'clock at the Aurora Theater, it starts at 7. So be there a little earlier. Doors open at 6, like you said, with an after party as well. Give us an idea of what these guys were up against at starting a new league. And it was surprising to me that, as you said, none of these guys even played high school or any kind of football before they started playing in wheelchairs.
Yeah, and I think it was really challenging from a coaching perspective too, as you know, Tim Wade will be able to sort of elaborate on. But you know, the whole league is starting from ground zero. So, you know, you have to understand that this is developing and this is a dynamic process where, you know, the playbook kind of had to be created on the fly because nobody knew, you know, what kind of routes were these guys capable of doing, you know, what is it going to be like when with jamming and blocking. So, you know, credit to the coaching staff is they're kind of making this stuff up on the fly. And, you know, as a filmmaker, that's what was exciting to me is to be a part of this on the ground floor and, you know, see the league develop because there's a ton of potential here, especially as more cities get involved.
And just so everybody's clear, all proceeds that are, you know, raised tonight through donations and at whatever other events you guys may have in the future, we're talking about benefiting Greater Buffalo Adaptive Sports, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And like to be more specific, you know, if you want to know exactly where this money goes to, I think that's important sometimes. They need a couple of things. One is travel. You know, they are traveling to tournaments all over the country this upcoming season, specifically in Salt Lake City and Chicago. So that's a big thing. But additionally, they need special wheelchairs that can withstand the type of impact and beating that these take during the game. I mean, we're talking about, you know, 15 mile an hour collisions. So they need to, you know, have custom wheelchairs that can withstand that. So that's another portion of what this money will be going towards.
What do you think the future is for this? How widely do you think it can spread? Do you foresee a 32 team league that mirrors kind of the NFL with a little, you know, like Super Bowl festivities, that kind of thing? Is there enough interest, or what do you see the future and how fast will it grow?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think our goal is just to create awareness so that this thing can build. I mean, the first year there was 9 teams. There's 11 this year. So the growth is going to be exponential. And especially once you have NFL teams on board supporting these initiatives, it's going to be huge. And, you know, you see at these tournaments, it brings a crowd, and, you know, there's sponsorships and there's activations, and these events are really cool. And, you know, again, I think once you get more NFL teams on board, there's no reason why there can't be, you know, 20, 30 of these programs.
It's called Concrete Gridiron. It is documenting Buffalo's first wheelchair football team. It will premiere tonight, 7 p.m. at the Aurora Theater in East Aurora. And again, all proceeds benefit Greater Buffalo Adaptive Sports, go towards supporting programs for disabled children and veterans of all ages as well. Jake, thanks very much for the time and kind of telling us how this all came to fruition. Congrats and good luck going forward with it.
I'll see you tonight, Jake.
Oh, I look forward to it. Talk to you guys.
Take care. That's Jake Zimmerman, who's the producer and director of Concrete Gridiron, highlighting Buffalo's first wheelchair football team. You know, I was watching the thing.
Yeah.
Collisions are fierce, man. Yeah. I'm just amazed they don't get their legs all chopped up, you know, in somebody else's wheel. I know they're angled right out to prevent that kind of thing from happening.
Yeah, the chairs are designed to,
I mean, they're jamming at the line of scrimmage. It's something else.
Yeah, it's amazing. And they, you know, these guys are, they really want to compete. They want to have fun. The game, and it was interesting. I had dinner with this coach, Tim Wade, who's a friend of mine, this last week, and asked him about all of this stuff. And he said they walked in completely blind to how the game was played, what the rules were. The rules were kind of made up as they went along, and, you know, how the game evolved and what plays were possible, what it really even looked like once they kicked it off, so to speak. They didn't know. They didn't even know what it looked like to line up. So it was truly a ground zero beginning point, and it'll be fun to watch it grow.
And his two sons are coaching along with him. They're his assistant coaches.
Andy and Eddie, two you know, great young guys, both here in Buffalo. And this team, the Buffalo team, that and we're seeing clips of it now, went to Kansas City for this tournament.
Yeah.
And, you know, they started out, they'd like to win a game, try and be competitive, and then all of a sudden, you know, the big highlight of it was they scored a touchdown, you know, against one of their opponents. That's how far they had to go. And, of course, now things are off and running. It was a great
– Yeah. And some great individual stories on that roster, as you were saying. You know, you got a former Army vet. You got a former gold medalist from the Paralympic Games. So there's some interesting stories on the roster, too. So good job by Jake and – hopefully they can raise a lot of money, not only for the team, but as we said, for disabled children and veterans of all ages in the greater Buffalo area. So cool stuff going on there. So good luck to them. Concrete Gridiron. And who knows? I mean, as they said, it's already expanding. Yeah. They're up to 11 teams now.
It'll be up tonight at 7 p.m. down in the Aurora Theater. $10 donation to get in. You can watch it. I think it's like an 18 to 20 minute.
I think it was 20 something minutes.
Yeah, 20 something minutes. It's a documentary, and it's actually pretty compelling. It's fun to watch, and it'll be a good time tonight.
Speaking of upstart football league, Steve, don't know if you saw this, but the USFL is going to have a second season. So they accomplished a feat that no spring football league, not affiliated with the NFL, has reached since the original USFL. They will have a second season in 2023. That, according to executive producer Eric Shanks, the USFL will return in 2023. All eight teams from its inaugural season will also be back. The league will continue to have its office in Birmingham, where they played all of their regular season games in 2022. However, in 2023, they're going to branch out a little bit. Not all the games will be fielded in Birmingham. They plan to have all eight teams play in 2 to 4 markets next year, with the eventual plan for all eight teams to play in their home markets. So, and it's not going to be easy, because next year, as we know, the XFL comes online, another spring football league set to join the fray here. So is there enough room for 2 spring football leagues? We'll find out starting in 2023.
There's a lot of football, and every time the NFL grows bigger, somebody else figures it's about football, or people just want to get people want to see these guys play. They want to see Von Miller and Josh Allen, Pat Mahomes and Brady and Rodgers and all.
Right.
They want to see those guys play football against some guys, and it's hard. And I've noticed this. I've caught USFL games, and I'm always. Once you tune in, you think, okay, let's watch. And they're competitive, and they're playing pretty good. And I don't know a single player on the field and don't have any skin in the game with either franchise. It's hard to hold my attention.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's hard to hold my attention. Maybe that's just a function of the ingrained nature of where I'm at. I mean, I'm obviously in a different place than a lot of people.
Right.
Right? I do have a little skin in the game of one of these franchises. So maybe that's it.
Makes a difference.
It does make a difference, but hey, kudos to them for making it, putting out another season, and starting to grow just a little bit.
So the USFL back in 2023, the XFL will join them. They will be relaunching next year after 2 attempts where the league could not get past a single full season. We'll see what happens and what their fate might be beginning next year. Let's go to the phones, though, at 803-0550. 1-888-550-2550, and we have Matt from Buffalo on the line. What do you have for us, Matt? You're on One Bills Live.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good.
So I heard the conversation with Jake. Just appreciate you guys putting us on there, and trying to spread the good word about wheelchair football.
So did you play, or?
Yes, I'm actually the veteran on the team, the Army vet.
Oh, cool. Oh,
very nice. Thanks for your service.
This is big. This is huge, and I'm glad to be a part of it. My teammates, everybody, we've improved over the first year. I mean, this is something I plan on sticking with for a long time. I'm very passionate, and so is the rest of the team.
Good stuff, man. I appreciate it. What has been the biggest change for you guys from maybe that first game there in Kansas City to where you're at now?
I'd have to say that one of the biggest things was learning – just learning the system of wheelchair football in general, learning, what the calls were going to be, the penalties, the field length and everything else. And especially the first 5-yard bump, like in the NFL, you got your first 5-yard bump to play against the wide receivers, so we can hit the chairs, but they have to release at a certain point. So going through the first season and seeing what we had to do, we had to change a lot of things. Our run game went to a passing game, so we're trying to build off of that right now. I mean, like I said, we're constantly improving, which is amazing. Each day in practice, we keep on getting better and better.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious, Matt.
Putting the finishing touches on it.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious, Matt, in terms of how much of a leg up did these other teams have? Because I'm guessing, this was your first year, so you were a new team. And how long had these other teams been playing wheelchair football? I'm curious what the gap was for you guys to make up.
Oh, geez. Yeah. See, this is when we got there, we thought at that point in time, we thought that everybody, it was their first year. But, come to find out, there were some teams that actually been doing it for the past 2-3 years, but maybe at an organized level, not necessarily with the league that we're in. Maybe they played some scrimmages. So a couple of these teams, and if I could be wrong, but almost every team, had experience with this. And then the chairs that they had, that was the biggest thing. Because I'm cracking people as much as I can on my chairs. And that's one thing that we're hoping, to get out of the donations for, the documentary is to upgrade our chairs because they kept breaking down. These guys had, you know, welded wheelchairs with their bumpers in the front, so nothing, you know, it wouldn't stop or stop them from moving properly and, you know, their agility and their movement. So that was one big thing, and that's what we're trying to do right now is trying to upgrade our wheelchairs.
Well, that's awesome to hear. I'm glad you called, Matt. Look forward to the premiere of Concrete Gridiron tonight. I wish you guys the best, and I hope the league grows wildly. It'll be fun to see you guys maybe have some exhibition games on a Sunday here in the fall.
Absolutely. That's what we're looking to do is in the future. We want to host one somewhere at Orchard Park. Maybe we work some out with the Bills. Do it right over there in their parking lot.
All right, Matt. Thanks for calling in. We appreciate it. Good luck tonight with the fundraiser.
All right, thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
All right, yeah, that's Matt, who's the guy that is a military veteran.
Featured
and,
in the in
yeah,
this,
he's actually one of the featured profiles in the doc tonight. So if you go to the Aurora Theater, you'll learn a lot more about him. I think the cool thing in the piece was how impressed he was that one of his teammates was a former Paralympic gold medalist. So he was it was funny. He was like a little kid. He's like, I'm on the same team as an Olympic gold medalist. Like, this is cool. Which was pretty neat. But yeah, so good luck to those guys tonight. Hopefully they can raise a lot of money and not only improve their equipment, which apparently is a bigger factor than everybody initially imagined in that sport, and they can also raise some money for, you know, disabled veterans and disabled youth in the Buffalo community. So
good stuff is something we can all do to help. It's a fun thing to do. It'll be a neat premiere tonight, and it'll be a chance for, if you want, you can go out and meet some of these guys at the after party to the screening of this documentary.
The OBL fan mailbag is up today on a rare Tuesday edition because this is our last show of the week before we get some time off during the July 4th holiday. And question coming in here from Andrew: do you think Singletary keeps the number one spot of the running back order, or do you think Cook takes it? I've kind of always been of the opinion, Steve, that this is going to be somewhat of a, I don't even know if I want to call it a committee backfield, more of a rotational backfield. I think Singletary will get the most work, certainly at the outset. But if Cook really impresses, there's, and who knows, in a given week, in a given game plan, Cook could very well be a bigger part of it if he has the kind of training camp and preseason that everybody's anticipating.
They're different players.
They are.
Singletary, we know what Devin Singletary is. He came on at the end of last year, finished up the season really well in the running game. And I think James Cook has a different skill set that is more conducive to, I think, modern NFL. I think the guy runs out, catches passes extremely well. He's a good running back, and I think his physical tools are probably a little step ahead of where Devin Singletary's are. But we've seen this movie before. The Bills don't just throw a guy out there because of where they drafted him. He'll have to earn it, and he'll have to carve out a role on the team, and the bigger the role, the more snaps he gets, and the sooner he'll play. We'll see what training camp brings and the preseason games.
You got to earn it here. That's the way McDermott operates, and I understand why. But as soon as he demonstrates a capability of executing, making plays, I don't think there's any question he's going to bring juice to the offensive backfield. And I'm not trying to discount the exploits of Duke Johnson, who is also a very accomplished receiving back. This kid just looks different, and I'm going to anticipate he's going to be on the field sooner rather than later.
Right.
It's just a matter of how much they choose to utilize him in a given week and how much, more importantly, Steve, how much he can handle. You know, there's a lot of testing that goes on with new players on the roster, both veteran and rookie. And with rookie, it is how much of the volume can he handle and then execute in the snap of a finger on the field.
Don't forget, too, that this coaching staff, you know, you spend a lot of time getting to know what your players can do and what they can't do. In the NFL these days, it's hard to find out about all you need to know about a player because there's not contact in practice.
Yeah.
You don't know if James Cook can pick up a blitzing linebacker at NFL level. You don't know if he can block on the edge or chip off the edge coming out of the backfield. You don't know if he can pick up the pass protection and execute the pass protection schemes when Josh changed him at the line of scrimmage. What matchups can he win in the pass route and in pass protection? Because there's no contact and no pads at practice, they don't know if he can do any of this stuff yet. So they got to kind of find out when live game reps come during the preseason or when one or two practices a week or every so often that they can find out if he can do it, at least against their own players. So right now, James Cook could be knocking it out of the park in shorts and T-shirts. We'll see what happens when they put pad. He's played a lot of football at a very high level. So you would think he's not going to be in over his head. But you still got to find out.
Yep. Break time for us here. When we come back, more of your questions from the OBL fan mailbag and a little NFL true-false coming your way. Those things next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kalata Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. Live, a special edition of the Fan Mailbag is open, and we'll take another question at this time. This one from Nick, who says, at this point, which position group are you least comfortable with going into this season? It's a pretty complete roster, Steve. Is there a position you're a little uncomfortable with? Be hard-pressed to find one.
I think if you pressed me, I would probably say, like what we've been saying, I would say depth at outside receiver. Behind Diggs and Davis, I'd question whether there's a top-flight guy right behind those two.
There's talent. A lot of it's unproven.
Certainly, there's enough slot receivers for three teams on this squad.
Right.
You know, so, but outside, I don't know if there's enough guys that have been proven with enough experience. Certainly, there's enough guys that know the offense. Hodgins will know the offense. Coomer will know the offense. Mm-hmm. But that's outside of Diggs and Davis. But proven guys, that's probably where I'd go. Where else are you looking? You know, I mean, that's about it.
Yeah, I would say the only other one for me that you might want to consider is depth at linebacker. You have Tyrell Dodson. Terrell Bernard, the third-round pick, is there. He's unproven at this level. So you have Joe Giles Harris on the roster as well. But the depth there, you could argue, might be a little cause for concern. But, I mean, I think we're really nitpicking here.
Yeah.
Because it's arguably the most complete roster in football. So that's probably the two places you could go.
The only knock that really doesn't really hold any water for the Bills is they've got a lot of new faces. You know, Settle, Phillips, Lawson, Daquan Jones, who else? The offensive line, Saffold, Kessenberry. They got a lot of new faces,
Greg
but
Mans.
The problem is the reason that it really doesn't make any ripples with people or concerned people is because that's what this team does every year. They incorporate these guys that are quality veterans really quickly into the group, and they thrive here in Buffalo. They become the best version of themselves. Plus, most of these guys do have some NFL chops, all these new faces. Von Miller, for instance. But you put all the new faces out there, and all of a sudden it looks like, wow, they got a lot of new guys that they're counting on. And while that's the case, this team has been the strength of this team is their ability to do that year in, year out. So this is nothing new to a Bills roster or a Bills coaching staff. So if you were going to raise eyebrows at anything about this roster, that might be it. But that is, you know, that's job one here in Buffalo. They do that every single year.
Yeah, it's splitting hairs, really, with this roster. It's pretty complete. Let's move along, Steve, to another edition of NFL True False, brought to you by Yancey's Fancy, New York's artisan cheese. First up on the NFL True False docket, tight end Rob Gronkowski will unretire in 2023. So we're looking at next year with this particular question.
I'm going to say that is a false. I can't see him not in 2023. If he's not, particularly if he doesn't unretire in 2022, he's not going to come back a year later.
I
think that's a – no, I think he's done.
I think the year changes this for me. 2023 makes me say false. I believe that come midseason, if the Bucs are in the hunt there in the NFC, and there's no reason to think they would not be, their division is down right now. Carolina's not going to threaten them. Neither is Atlanta. And even New Orleans has a new coach. And, you know, they've got some work to do there.
Right.
So the Bucs are probably going to be atop their division. Halfway through the season, if they're one of the top three seeds, Brady's lobbing a call to Gronk and say, hey, finish out this last ride with me. What do you say?
Right.
And I could see him coming back this year. Next year, no. Not a chance. So I would say false for 2023 for Gronk to unretire.
Both of us think that's false.
Okay, number two on the NFL true-false docket, most defensive players would rather face Tom Brady than Peyton Manning.
And we're talking about in their prime, right?
Yes.
Well, neither one's a bargain. Tom Brady than Peyton Manning.
Who would you rather play defense?
I guess probably so. They're both the same guy. Brady's probably got a better arm, even if
I think Brady's more of an assassin. And I would say that Manning is more of the professor.
Yeah.
When it comes to playing the quarterback position, both Manning, are highly intelligent players.
Yeah, they're both probably gonna beat you. So take your pick. But I think Brady. You're right. I think Brady's got a killer instinct that Peyton Manning is more of a surgical approach to everything. But Brady's just got a killer instinct. So I'm saying false. Then I think they'd rather face. Well, I think they'd rather face Manning than Brady.
Okay.
I'd say it's false.
Yeah. All right. I don't particularly care for Brady. I respect both of their games. I don't know. I can't get past my utter hatred for Brady. So I am going to say false as well. And it's interesting because this stems from a comment that Bart Scott had made, who had played against both Brady and Manning multiple times, and it was his opinion that Manning was much more difficult to play against. He said Manning was such a master of the mental side of football that defensive players would lie awake at night with anxiety about what Manning might do, where Brady's success was more a function of the people around him. It's Scott's opinion that Tom Brady was more about Bill Belichick, the entire team, the execution, than having a game plan. And I could see why he would have that opinion, because there was a long stretch of time there. Manning didn't have much of a defense to help him in Indianapolis. So much so that there were times in games where Manning, for the entire game, when the offense was on the field, would run the play clock down to 2 or 1 second to eat up as much time on a drive as possible so his defense wouldn't have to be out on the field defending.
Right. Yeah, Peyton was a different guy, and I've said this before. Peyton covered a multitude of deficiencies on the teams that he played for. I'm a big believer. It's my belief that Peyton is the guy that got the Denver Broncos to that Super Bowl against the Seattle Seahawks and then got eaten alive after having a quintessential, over-the-top, best offensive year of any offense in the history of the National Football League. They got their heads handed to him because the defense,
he had like 55 touchdown passes.
Right. The defense that they faced in that Super Bowl exposed everything that Peyton Manning had covered up for the entire season. Their offensive line was not athletic, couldn't pass protect.
All right, our apologies to you, the listening audience, the viewing audience. We had a power outage here at One Bills Drive as Steve was mid-sentence in explaining.
So you're welcome for not having to listen to my dribble until I finally wound it up.
We are going to wind up with one final NFL true-false to throw at you, and this one is Bears quarterback Justin Fields is the NFL's biggest off-season loser. And what this is getting at is this guy has been set up to fail more than any other quarterback in the NFL this offseason. What say you, Steve Tasker?
Is Justin Fields still on the Chicago Bears?
He is.
Then he is the biggest loser.
What? So you're answering true.
Yeah, that's true.
It is. It has been an offseason of change for the Bears.
New head coach.
Matt Eberflus.
They got rid of every, well, they downgraded at almost every position.
Allen Robinson is gone. He's in L.A. with the Rams.
The Bears are going to be the Chicago Bears again. So
Darnell Mooney is his only receiver of note, the only proven player who is the one being highlighted on MSG right now. Matt Eberflus is the new head coach, as Steve mentioned. They have a new offensive coordinator who is supposed to take advantage with his scheme of Fields' mobility more. In Luke Getsy, we'll see if that happens. But if you want to say there is not a lot for Justin Fields to work with, you would not be incorrect.
Yeah.
So I think there's a very good chance that he is the biggest offseason loser. I will say true, but I will say it with a bit of sympathy for one Justin Fields.
Luke Getsy is the offensive coordinator. It's a new scheme that they're going to be trying. It's supposed to be very quarterback-friendly. It's tailored to Fields' skill set. This all sounds like preseason new regime rhetoric to me.
Yeah.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Well, I mean, I think you could make some progress despite all of these changes, but as we've seen here in Buffalo with young quarterbacks, you keep changing the coaches and the coordinators and the schemes. Very hard for him to get better.
Here's the acid test. If Mitch Trubisky left Chicago, spent a year in Buffalo, then goes to Pittsburgh and plays well for the Steelers, you'll know that Chicago is a quarterback graveyard. As their former great quarterback said, Jim McMahon said, it's where quarterbacks go to die. Watch Mitch Trubisky play in Pittsburgh, and we'll see how much better he plays with a team that knows what it's doing.
That's not a bad barometer. That is NFL True False, brought to you by Yancey's Fancy, New York's artisan cheese. We need to remind you that Steve and I will be going on a brief hiatus. It is our time to get some R&R. So we thank you for listening. We will be back July 6th, and then we'll be off again because they'll have the NHL draft extended shows with Marty and Duffer. So enjoy your 4th of July holiday. Thanks for listening. Steve and I are out for about a week. We'll catch up with you a week from Wednesday. Take care, everybody.